folks, I'm Alfred Adask, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. Our guest tonight is James Corbett from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. He talks to us from Japan. He's been a regular guest for a year or thereabouts. I'm not sure how long you've been coming here, James, but we always enjoy having you here. You've been missing in action for the last 3 weeks while you were visiting Canada, your home country of Canada. Took your wife and child there. And how was your trip?
It was great. It was exhausting. I am completely exhausted now, but ready to go, raring to go.
Come home to rest up. Come home from the vacation.
Yeah, that's
rest
pretty much it.
Did you really take a vacation and forget about international politics and economics for a few weeks, or was it on your mind the whole time?
I really did, actually. So you might throw a few curveballs at me, and I might not be able to answer them. But I was keeping an eye on Greece, obviously, and China, and what's going on there. But I'm not 100% up on everything yet. So let's dig in and see what we can get our teeth into.
Let's start with Greece. Were you surprised by the Greek Prime Minister Tsipras' capitulation to the creditors' extremely harsh demands? You know, a lot of people looked at the proposals and they said, Greece will never go along with this. They made this harsh because they didn't want Greece to go along. Somebody wanted this negotiation to fail. And yet Tsipras came along and said, okay, we'll go along with it.
Yes, I suppose I'd say on the bigger scale of things, I'm not surprised. In fact, this is pretty much what I was expecting when Syriza first came into power, that they're just another hope and change that are promising the moon and will deliver nothing. And that's ultimately what's resulted. In fact, they've not only delivered nothing, they've actually put Greece in a worse position than they were when they first came into office. So from that perspective, I'm not surprised. Although the circuitous route we took to get here is a bit surprising and a bit puzzling in some respects. What was the point of the referendum, which was then immediately not only backtracked on, but completely disregarded and gone completely the other way? Of course, the referendum on whether or not Greece should accept or reject the European bailout proposal. And of course, the Greek people voted quite substantially. I believe it was 61% or 62% to no, they should not go along with the European bailout proposal. And then immediately, almost, it seems, Tsipras went and concluded pretty much everything that the bailout proposal had originally was asking for. So that was a pretty strange way to do that. And I guess there is a lot of speculation about what was really going on there. One of the most interesting pieces of speculation I've seen is that apparently Tsipras had asked Putin in his visit with Putin that he took just as this was coming to a head. He had asked for $10 billion loan or some sort of aid in order to start printing drachmas and to basically remove Greece from the Eurozone. And Putin didn't go along with it. So he was left with no choice but to basically to backtrack on everything he had said. That's one of the theories going around. And that's not a confirmed report, but it's at least one potential explanation for why that particular it doesn't make sense from any perspective. Of course, it's also political suicide, because of course everyone who did ultimately support Syriza and what they were saying are now obviously left in the ditch and even worse, in a worse position than they were before, which one can only imagine will only be felt by Syriza at the next election.
Are we going to see a third bailout or a Grexit? This isn't yet a done deal, or at least not obviously, not officially.
It's not all dusted and tied in a bow yet, but it's certainly moving along towards that point. We've already seen the extension of the emergency liquidity for the banks, and we've seen the promise of a payment to tide over the IMF payments that are due and things of that nature. And we've just seen the Greek parliament vote on the second round of pledges to basically go along with this austerity program. So it seems that everything is on track for just a kicking of the can and a further bailout program. And there are some notable voices out there that are against the idea of this going forward. Of course, perhaps most notably the German finance minister Schäuble. But other than that, I think it does seem like it is going to go ahead at this point. So I imagine at this point we are looking at Greece basically just being continued along the path that it's been for the last several years. And I have no doubt that it will come to the head once again. I mean, I think everyone, even the IMF at this point, admits that there will need to be a debt haircut, that they they literally can't pay the debt levels that are being that they are supposedly obligated to pay at this point. It's just a question of how that ultimately that haircut takes place and in what fashion.
Well, they've already reduced the debt by half, 53%, if I recall correctly, back, I don't know, 2 years ago. They reduced the debt by, the existing debt then was reduced by half, and now they're going to have to reduce it again, and I don't think half is going to be enough. Christine Lagarde at the IMF, she said, in order for this to work, we're going to have to give the Greeks a 30-year grace period before they start paying on the debt. You give me a 30-year grace period on before I have to start paying on a debt, and you're never going to see any of them. That's an admission. I'm never going to pay.
I'm buying a mansion tomorrow, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying. I mean, it is ridiculous. And of course, this is always and in every context, it's put into the context of, oh, those Greeks, those lazy, good for nothing Greeks took on more debt than they can bear. When, of course, it was, of course, the political class, not the Greek people themselves that were behind the scenes putting these kind of machinations in place, aided, of course, by Goldman Sachs, who enabled Greece to cook its books. I mean, this is now admitted and on the record official history. Goldman Sachs helped Greece cook its books in order to even gain admittance to the Eurozone. And I think that what this really speaks to is the utter absurdity of the Eurozone itself and its oversight and regulatory processes for allowing members into the Eurozone organization, and then even just the idea of this regional currency that has a regional central bank, but is a bunch of different economies with, in many cases, very little whatsoever in common that are going to use a common currency. I mean, it's by its very nature, it's designed to fail. There's no way that this can actually work. Unless, of course, the European Central Bank starts to act more and more as the central bank for each of these individual countries. And I still think that this is ultimately where this crisis is heading, if not necessarily right now and not in the Greek case, then maybe in the Spanish case or the Portuguese case or one of these other peripheral countries that are going to crash and burn. I think ultimately the idea is going to be, well, the ECB needs more and more power to act in individual countries. And it's actually, in a strange way, although it should be the end of the Eurozone, I think in many ways it's actually going to seek to actually consolidate the power of the people who created this problem.
That may be. Back in the 1990s, South Korea had a financial problem, and I don't remember exactly when, but in 97, thereabouts, I can't recall clearly. And they entered into an agreement with the International Monetary Fund. The agreement was about 40 pages long, as I recall, and it wasn't supposed to be released to the public, but someone got a copy and posted it on the Internet. And I read that agreement, and I can remember it was like trying to chew through a bale of hay. It was hard to read, and I nevertheless chewed through the whole 30, 40 pages, whatever it was, and what became apparent to me, this isn't just suspicion or misunderstanding, the IMF essentially said, we will bail you out of your bankruptcy, provided that you surrender the primary levels of economic power in your country to the IMF and or representatives of the IMF. It was a takeover of South Korea by the IMF. And I have no doubt that what we're seeing with the current agreement with Greece is much the same. This isn't just, gee, you owe us some money, we're going to have to make an agreement here in order. No, this is a takeover. Greece has become a colony. And in South Korea, in my opinion, became a colony back in the late 1990s. And here Greece is doing the same thing. And for me, this is evidence what the IMF does. Gets you into debt and then makes you an offer you can't refuse. It's like dealing with Don Corleone. Instead of Christine Lagarde, she learned everything she knows from Don Corleone.
Well, may I just add that I think you're exactly right about what happened in Korea. And for people who don't know that history, Professor Michelle Chostodowski of the Center for Research on Globalization at globalresearch.ca has done some extensive work on that in the past. And he had this article called The Recolonization of Korea, Seoul Black Monday, IMF Intervention in Korea, that talks in specific detail about this and has a pretty interesting quotation in here about the deal that was ultimately reached, which is that foreign investors can freely buy our entire financial sector, including 26 banks, 27 security firms, 12 insurance companies, and 21 merchant banks, all of which are listed on the Korean Stock Exchange, for just 5.5 trillion won, that is $3.7 billion. So basically, it was a fire sale of much of the Korean financial sector that took place as a result specifically of that IMF agreement. And it really was a turning point, I think, for Korea financially.
I can tell you another story. I knew a man named Terry Lofton. He passed away a couple of years ago now. And 20 years ago, we had meetings called Citizens for Legal Reform here in Dallas. And I came to know Terry while he attended the meetings. And he would go to libraries when they were throwing out all old law books. And he'd buy them by a pickup truck at a time. He'd buy all those books. He'd collect this stuff. He was serious about accumulating this knowledge. He wound up acquiring three-ring binders that were the operations manual for the Federal Reserve. He bought them at an estate sale, and someone had them who must have been connected at one point. He died, and they were there, the heirs didn't care. They sold these three-ring binders. If you wanted to see them today, you can go to the Federal Reserve. They're undoubtedly updated and whatever, but you make an appointment. They'll schedule you for, who knows, 3-6 months from now. You can spend 30 minutes observing these books. You can't take any notes, recording devices, pencils, pens, paper, any of the rest of it. You got 30 minutes. You can look at it. And after the 30 minutes, you leave. And if you'd like to schedule again, they might be able to get you in within, another 6 months. Now, this was valuable documents. Terry wound up selling them to an airline pilot who told me later on that he just threw them in the trash because they weren't doing him any good. To me, this was like throwing out a copy of the Gutenberg Bible. But here's the point. Lofton read that operation, those three volumes of the operations manuals. And they specifically said that the Federal Reserve would not loan money to alternative energy entities. And this is back in the 90s. If you had a solar energy project, you weren't going to get any money if the Federal Reserve had anything to say about it. If you wanted to wind power or any of the rest, you weren't going to get any money insofar as the Federal Reserve could stop it from happening. The only thing they'd lend money on was traditional energy, coal, petroleum, and nuclear. Now, the point to all of this is that the Federal Reserve was controlling energy policy in this country, or at least influencing energy policy, by simply saying, these inventors over here, this technology, it won't get any funding to mention. They'll get some, but not what they might otherwise have expected. This is more evidence that the banks are controlling this country and South Korea and now Greece, and I don't know where else. But they're exerting a level of control that goes deep into the economic system, deep into the political system. And I'm going to guess that's not contrary to your experience, but I'm going to guess you perhaps haven't heard that story before about the Federal Reserve's operation manual.
I believe we've discussed it on this program before, but only through that, yes.
Yeah,
the point is well taken, because really and truly the power over credit is the power to, if not directly control, at least greatly influence the direction that a society will take. And just as easily as they can direct monies away from alternative energy and towards the coal or oil or nuclear form of power, so too could they flip on a dime and do the opposite next week, or whatever else in whatever other sectors of society they want. And that really is, I mean, the fundamental basis by which banksters can really direct the course of a country and ultimately of a civilization. Because let's keep in mind, I mean, the Federal Reserve is itself really just a cartelization of the private corporations of the banks that make up the Federal Reserve. And ultimately, they all start to merge together in terms of the Bank for International Settlements, which is the central bank of central banks, so that ultimately there really is a global network of bankers who have the authority and the ability to do exactly what you're discussing there, not just on a national level, but on an international level. And we see the fruits of this from time to time when a shearing of the sheep comes necessary and they start putting their hands in, out for the payback that to all of the golden loans from heaven that they've put out in the past. And again, it's really and truly the power of life and death over countries, if not individual people, and sometimes over individual people.
It's consistent with Baron Rothschild's remark that he had words to this effect. He said, "I don't care who makes the laws so long as I can control the issuance of money in the country." And they make all laws you want. Doesn't matter to me as long as I can control the money. He didn't. That wasn't precisely what he said, but words to that effect. It is astonishing. You know, most people don't understand much about money other than how to count it. You know, we know that the 5 is better than the 1 and the 10 is better yet. But other than that, people don't realize how much power there is in being able to issue money, control money, and so on. We're going to talk about liquidity when we come back. We're going to take a break right now for a couple of commercial announcements, and I'll be back with James Corbett from the CorbettReport.com. Please stay tuned. Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adisk. Our guest is James Corbett from the Corbett Report. We're going to talk a little about liquidity, which is a relatively new concept, at least to me. I only began to see it maybe a month ago, 6 weeks at the most. I began to see articles. People are warning, there's a liquidity. We have low liquidity. And what did that mean? I didn't know exactly. I've been looking since then. Here's an article from Business Insider. Deals with the topic. It says, "This week's gold crash reminds us of a much scarier risk in the markets." And they attributed the gold crash, where gold got knocked down this last week, to low liquidity. And the article continues. It says, "What is liquidity? Broadly speaking, liquidity measures how easily traders and investors can buy and sell an asset in the market without seeing big price dislocations. When liquidity is low, selling can cause prices to plummet." Okay, that's one definition. They go on, they've got another one down below. Here's Deutsche Bank, and they're saying there is no single best metric for the level of liquidity in the market, which to me it means it's like obscenity. I can't define it, but I know it when I see it. They're saying we can't quite get a definition on liquidity. Oaktree Capital's Howard Merks offered a slightly less technical and more philosophical definition. "The key criteria isn't can you sell it. It's can you sell it at a price equal or close to the last price. For them to be truly liquid, these investments to be truly liquid, one has to be able to move them promptly and without the imposition of a material discount." Now, the problem with how can we talk about liquidity if we don't have a solid definition that we can all sort of agree to and understand? And do you have a single reliable definition for liquidity and the threat it poses right now?
I don't think that I could define it any better than any of those previous definitions. And the concept, I think, might be difficult to wrap your head around because most people are not used to buying or selling in conditions or with volumes that would actually affect the price of the thing that they are buying or selling. If we go to buy a pack of gum at a store, it's not going to affect the price of packs of gum everywhere. But when we're talking about large trades and large deals and a very fast pace of selling on large markets, we can actually see that if you try to dump a large amount of stock all at once, of course, you're not going to get the same price as if you were selling that stock slowly into the market. I mean, there's just a certain way in which that those types of large transactions function. And again, that can be difficult to see how that actually means anything. But interestingly, people point, for example, to last October, specifically October 15th, when there was a Treasury flash crash that many people may not have heard of, but there was a shortage of liquidity in the Treasury, the U.S. Treasury markets, that that launched a 37 basis point slide in yields in 2 hours. And to put that into perspective, statistically, when they try to make a calculation of how likely that is to occur, that's something that should happen once in over 500 million days, i.e. that is not something that should be occurring unless something is very, very, very wrong with the markets. So the question is, what is wrong with the markets? And the whole liquidity mess, as it's being termed these days, is really centering on the U.S. bond market, the treasuries, and specifically because of the QE program and the zero interest rate ZERP policy that's been in place for years now has really, really skewed the market. And to put that into perspective, at the height of the Fed's purchasing of treasuries, the Fed itself was responsible for 80% of U.S. Treasury purchases. So this is a market that is really, I mean, there isn't much room for large amounts of selling to take place, because there is really only has been for many years now only one principal buyer, the Fed itself. And if people start dumping bonds in large quantities, there's probably not going to be a buyer for them, which means they're not going to get the price that they theoretically should get for that. That's the problem of this liquidity mess, this liquidity trap, and it's only being exacerbated by the fact that the Fed seems absolutely hell-bent on hiking rates this year, perhaps as early as September, as some people are saying. So what we're seeing is a turnaround in a 30-year trend of falling Treasury rates, and we're about to start seeing some hikes. And who knows how this is going to unfold, but it's hard to wrap your mind around a way in which this will unfold nicely for anyone. It really is a bubble. I mean, that's essentially what it is. And the question is, can you put the needle in the bubble in such a way that the air slowly escapes in a way that won't hurt too many people? I've never seen a bubble act that way, but maybe the wizards at the Fed think that they can do this. I don't think so. I think that the only way down from here is a sharp crash in not only the treasuries, but of course everything that's affected by them. One of the effects of the fact that the Fed has been pumping money into treasuries and lowering the rates artificially is that investors have been looking for high returns elsewhere, which means that they have gone into much more risky corporate bonds and into the stock market generally, which has created the stock market bubble. And of course, if the treasuries start to unwind, that will unwind that further bubble that's been created from all of this. So there are a series of headaches that are created by the fact that we're at this very illiquid position in the U.S. Treasury markets, and we are going to start seeing the effects of this when and if the Fed starts its rate hikes.
Let me run this by you. I've been thinking about the liquidity and low liquidity problem, and the way it's described and the way it's defined, the definitions seem a little confusing and hard to follow and hard to wrap your mind around. But what it amounts to is opposing, I have a property that I assume is worth $100,000. It could be a $100,000 bond. It could be a $100,000 piece of land. And you have $100,000, and you might be interested in buying that property. Now, are you going to snap that property up right now? It depends. If we were to define liquidity as inflation, a condition of inflation, and you sat back and said, wait, I'll sell them that property for 100 grand, and I know that thing's going to go to 150,000 by the end of the year. I'd grab that right now and make a fast 50 grand. In the context of inflation, the prices will go up. But in the context of deflation, if I've got that same property, I'm selling it for $100,000, you've got $100,000, you're going to sit back there and say, I don't want to buy that property. I'm not paying $100,000 for that property. I know the price is going down, and I know the purchasing power of my dollar is going up. I can get that property at a better deal 6 months from now, a year from now. So I'm not going to buy right now. What I'm suggesting is that low liquidity is simply a euphemism for deflation. And liquidity in general, when there's adequate liquidity, it's just another word for saying we're in an inflationary period. Price is going up, value of the dollar is going down. I don't mind parting, or you wouldn't mind parting with $100,000 to buy the property because you think the price is going to go up. And you know the purchasing power, your dollar is going down because we're in a period of inflation. Does that make any sense to you?
It does. I would just qualify that by saying that I think inflation or deflation, that what environment you're in, certainly does have an effect on the liquidity of a market. But that's only one of the factors, I think.
I agree that it's one of the factors, but I'm just saying primary environment. And if it were true, if that hypothesis were true, then when the federal government can't sell its bonds to anybody but the Federal Reserve, and they have low liquidity, is that evidence that we are in a period of deflation?
Not necessarily.
I get that, but it's consistent with that idea. To my mind,
I certainly see what you're saying, and I would say that the simplest way to think about liquidity would say that there's an, if not exact harmony, but a nice balance between motivated buyers and motivated sellers. Mm-hmm. That there's some sort of relation there, and yes, one of the things that would demotivate someone from buying would be a deflationary environment. Mm-hmm. One thing that would demotivate people from selling would be an inflationary environment. So that's one of the factors that throws that balance off. So it's not necessarily a sign that you're in a deflationary environment, but it could be one of the factors that goes into that. And I think in this case, it probably is. I mean, I think clearly in the commodities, we are seeing a deflationary environment that has been caused by this blowing up of the bond bubble and then the secondary bubble in the equities markets that is now translating into this plunge in. Well, I mean, oil, although there are a lot of factors in that, and gold and a lot of other commodities are, of course, plunging
at
this time.
On the other hand, has been growing in purchasing power over the last 15, 16 months. It's up 20%. It was up 25% for a while. It's still up 20% the last 15, 16 months, if I understand correctly. That is deflation, and at least on the international level, as measured by U.S. dollar index. It's one of those things, look at it, it's kind of like Arsenio Hall. People are going to, maybe there's some point to it.
Right.
You've watched the Iranian deal.
Yes.
And the reason I call it deal is because I have an article from the Washington Examiner. And they talk about the agreement that was reached, a preliminary agreement between the Obama administration and Iran. And they refer to it five times in a 250-word article as a deal. And not once did they refer to it as a treaty. Now, the report in the Washington Examiner, it's not legal, it's not a legal document, but still it's odd to me that this agreement is called a deal but not a treaty, seemingly between two or more countries. It sounds like a treaty to me, but Article 2, Section 2, Clause 2, the Constitution of the United States says the Senate shall provide advice and consent on treaties. Two-thirds of the Senate has to agree to ratify a treaty after it's been negotiated with by the president. And yet in the Iranian deal, we have the House of Representatives is called on to approve this agreement. The problem I have is there's no proviso in the Constitution for the House of Representatives to ratify any treaties. And why aren't we simply leaving this exclusively to the Senate to ratify or not ratify the Iranian deal? And I'm wondering if the use of the word deal signals that they know they're not drafting a treaty. It's not ratified by the Senate. The House is in this, and there's no constitutional foundation for it. Do you have an explanation?
Well, I think I might. I don't believe this is technically a treaty is not being treated as such. It is technically referred to as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which is an agreement And I don't want to start parsing the legality of these different terms, but I have never seen the word treaty used in the context of this negotiation. So I believe this is a different legal entity altogether, and one that obviously does not require, according to the laws of the land, the participation of the Senate or the ratification of the House. So it is a comprehensive plan of action, which I assume means that there are certain obligations for the Iranians under this plan, and certain obligations then in response from the P5+1. Basically, America and Europe to ease sanctions, but I think it's more in the framework of an agreement rather than a treaty that is being legalized in that sense. So I don't know what a joint comprehensive plan of action legally is or what purview it comes under, but my understanding is that it is not a treaty.
Well, I would agree with you. Since the Senate is not the ratifying agency, it can't be a treaty under the Constitution, but again, it raises a very interesting question. If it's not a treaty and it involves foreign countries, some sort of an agreement between foreign countries, but it's not a treaty, what is it? And are we bound by it? Who is bound by an agreement that is not a treaty? Does this extend down to the people of the United, the people in Texas? Are we bound by this agreement? And I'll make you a bet that the fast track legal process that they've authorized for the use of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, I'll make you bet it's the same thing. The fast-track legislation is authorized by the House of Representatives. That's not a treaty. I looked it up a little bit. NAFTA was done under fast-track. It indicates there wasn't really a treaty. There were a number of different agreements that the House ratified, and the Senate was not involved, so far as I know. But the House can't be treaty. What are they, and what are the legal effects, and who's bound by them? Inquiring minds.
Yes, absolutely. It is an important thing, and there's a long legislative history and judicial history behind this, and I've written about it in the Forecaster before, talking about treaties and the fact that they can actually undermine constitutional
That's why this
law
is so important, because yes, many of the treaties that people are concerned about, they say, oh, this treaty is undermining. Well, is it a treaty? Was it ratified by the Senate, or was it approved by the House? If it was approved,
yes,
by the House, it's not a treaty under the Constitution.
Right.
What is the
Well, I see that CNN has a post on precisely this from March of this year, talking about the Iranian negotiations. Iran deal, a treaty or not a treaty, that is the question. And it says, it opens by saying, if it looks like a treaty, walks like a treaty, and talks like a treaty, is it a treaty? According to the White House, only if the president of the United States says it is. And so, of course, this infuriated John McCain, who said this is clearly a treaty. They can call it a banana, but it's a treaty. So it sounds like legalized wrangling
to basically make
this sound
again
different.
These are strange times and strange questions, and we're going to have to leave answers to this one for another time. James, I'm glad to hear you back on the program. It's always a pleasure talking to you. James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. CORBETT report.com. I'm Alfred Addis. I want to thank all of you for listening. Hope you'll tune in again tomorrow. In the meantime, with good Lord bless you, me, James, and Frank the producer. Good night.